pounds soaking wet. "What can we do about it?" I ask him, more harshly than I intended. "Nothing to do," he says back. "Just making conversation." Now that I know she's there, it's hard to ignore the child. She slips up and joins us at different stations. Like me, she's clever with plants, climbs swiftly, and has good aim. She can hit the target every time with a slingshot. But what is a slingshot against a 220-pound male with a sword? Back on the District 12 floor, Hamish and Effie grill us throughout breakfast and dinner about every moment of the day. What we did, who watched us, how the other tributes size up. Cinna and Portia aren't around, so there's no one to add any sanity to the meals. Not that Hamish and Effie are fighting anymore. Instead, they seem to be of one mind, determined to whip us into shape. Full of endless directions about what we should do and not do in training. Peeta is more patient, but I have become fed up and surly. When we finally escape to bed on the second night, Peeta mumbles,
"Someone ought to get Hamish a drink."
I make a sound that is somewhere between a snort and a laugh. Then catch myself. It's messing with my mind too much, trying to keep straight when we're supposedly friends and when we're not. At least when we get into the arena, I'll know where we stand. "Don't. Don't let's pretend when there's no one around."
"All right, Katniss," he says tiredly.
After that, we only talk in front of people. On the third day of training, they start to call us out of lunch for our private sessions with the game makers. District by district, first the boy, then the girl tribute. As usual, District 12 is slated to go last. We linger in the dining room, unsure where else to go. No one comes back once they have left. As the room empties, the pressure to appear friendly lightens. By the time they call Rue, we are left alone. We sit in silence until they summon Peeta. He rises.
"Remember what Hamish said about being sure to throw the weights?"
The words come out of my mouth without permission.
"Thanks. I will," he says. "You. Shoot straight."
I nod. I don't know why I said anything at all. Although, if I'm going to lose, I'd rather Peeta win than the others. Better for our district, for my mother and Prim. After about 15 minutes, they call my name. I smooth my hair, set my shoulders back, and walk into the gymnasium. Instantly, I know I'm in trouble. They've been here too long, the game makers. Sat through 23 other demonstrations. Had too much wine, most of them. Want more than anything to go home. There's nothing I can do but continue with the plan. I walk to the archery station. Oh, the weapons. I've been itching to get my hands on them for days. Bows made of wood and plastic and metal and materials I can't even name. Arrows with feathers cut in flawless uniform lines. I choose a bow, string it, and sling the matching quiver of arrows over my shoulder. There's a shooting range, but it's much too limited. Standard bullseyes and human silhouettes. I walk to the center of the gymnasium and pick my first target. The dummy used for knife practice. Even as I pull back on the bow, I know something is wrong. The string's tighter than the one I use at home. The arrow's more rigid. I miss the dummy by a couple of inches and lose what little attention I had been commanding. For a moment, I'm humiliated. Then I head back to the bullseye. I shoot again and again until I get the feel of these new weapons. Back in the center of the gymnasium, I take an initial position and skewer the dummy right through the heart. Then I sever the rope that holds the sandbag for boxing, and the bag splits open as it slams to the ground. Without pausing, I shoulder roll forward,
come up on one knee and send an arrow into one of the hanging lights above the gymnasium floor. A shower of sparks bursts from the fixture. It's excellent shooting. I turn to the game makers. A few are nodding approval, but the majority of them are fixated on a roast pig that has just arrived at their banquet table. Suddenly, I am furious that with my life on the line, they don't even have the decency to pay attention to me. That I'm being upstaged by a dead pig. My heart starts to pound. I can feel my face burning. Without thinking, I pull an arrow from my quiver and send it straight at the game maker's table. I hear shouts of alarm as people stumble back. The arrow skewers the apple in the pig's mouth and pins it to the wall behind it. Everyone stares at me in disbelief. "Thank you for your consideration," I say. Then I give a slight bow and walk straight toward the exit without being dismissed. Chapter 8. As I stride toward the elevator, I fling my bow to one side and my quiver to the other. I brushed past the gaping Avoxes who guard the elevators and hit the number 12 button with my fist. The doors slide together and I zip upward. I actually make it back to my floor before the tears start running down my cheeks. I can hear the others calling me from the sitting room, but I fly down the hall into my room, bolt the door, and fling myself onto my bed. Then I really begin to sob. Now I've done it. Now I've ruined everything. If I'd stood even a ghost of a chance, it vanished when I sent that arrow flying at the game makers. What will they do to me now? Arrest me? Execute me? Cut my tongue and turn me into an Avox so I can wait on the future tributes of Panem? What was I thinking, shooting at the game makers? Of course I wasn't. I was shooting at that apple because I was so angry at being ignored. I wasn't trying to kill one of them. If I were, they'd be dead. Oh, what does it matter? It's not like I was going to win the games anyway. Who cares what they do to me? What really scares me is what they might do to my mother and Prim, how my family might suffer now because of my impulsiveness. Will they take their few belongings, or send my mother to prison and Prim to the community home, or kill them? They wouldn't kill them, would they? Why not? What do they care? I should have stayed and apologized. Or laughed like it was a big joke. Then maybe I would have found some leniency. But instead, I stalked out of the place in the most disrespectful manner possible. Hamish and Effie are knocking on my door. I shout for them to go away, and eventually they do. It takes at least an hour for me to cry myself out. Then I just lay curled up on the bed, stroking the silken sheets, watching the sun set over the artificial candy capital. At first, I expect guards to come for me, but as time passes, it seems less likely. I calm down. They still need a girl tribute from District 12, don't they? If the game makers want to punish me, they can do it publicly. Wait until I'm in the arena and six starving wild animals on me. You can bet they'll make sure I don't have a bow and arrow to defend myself. Before that, though, they'll give me a score so low, no one in their right mind would sponsor me. That's what will happen tonight. Since the training isn't open to viewers, the game makers announce a score for each player. It gives the audience a starting place for the betting that will continue throughout the games. The number, which is between 1 and 12, 1 being irredeemably bad and 12 being unattainably high, signifies the promise of the tribute. The mark is not a guarantee of which person will win. It's only an indication of the potential a tribute showed in training. Often, because of the variables in the actual arena, high-scoring tributes go down almost immediately. And a few years ago, the boy who won the games only received a 3. Still, the scores can help or hurt an individual tribute in terms of sponsorship. I had been hoping my shooting skills might get me a 6 or a 7, even if I'm not particularly powerful. Now I'm sure I'll have the lowest score of the 24. If no one sponsors me, my odds of staying alive decrease to almost 0. When Effie taps on the door to call me to dinner, I decide I may as well go. The scores will be televised tonight. It's not like I can hide what happened forever. I go to the bathroom and wash my face, but it's still red and splotchy. Everyone's waiting at the table, even Cinna and Portia. I wish the stylists hadn't shown up because for some reason I don't like the idea of disappointing them. It's as if I've thrown away all the good work they did on the opening ceremonies without a thought. I avoid looking at anyone as I take tiny spoonfuls of fish soup. The saltiness reminds me of my tears. The adults begin some chit-chat about the weather forecast, and I let my eyes meet Peeta's. He raises his eyebrows. A question. What happened? I just give my head a small shake. Then, as they're serving the main course, I hear Haymitch say,
"Okay, enough small talk. Just how bad were you today?"
Peeta jumps in.
"I don't know that it mattered. By the time I showed up, no one even bothered to look at me. They were singing some kind of drinking song, I think. So I threw around some heavy objects until they told me I could go."
That makes me feel a bit better. It's not like Peeta attacked the game makers, but at least he was provoked too.
"And you, sweetheart?" says Haymitch.
Somehow, Haymitch calling me sweetheart ticks me off enough that I'm at least able to speak. "I shot an arrow at the game makers." Everyone stops eating.
"You what?"
The horror in Effie's voice confirms my worst suspicions. "I shot an arrow at them. Not actually at them, in their direction. It's like Peeta said. I was shooting, and they were ignoring me, and I just lost my head. So I shot an apple out of their stupid roast pig's mouth," I say defiantly.
"And what did they say?" says Cinna carefully.
"Nothing. Or I don't know. I walked out after that," I say.
"Without being dismissed?"
gasps Effie. "I dismissed myself," I said. I remember how I promised Prim that I really would try to win, and I feel like a ton of coal has dropped on me.
"Well, that's that," says Haymitch.
Then he butters a roll.
"Do you think they'll arrest me?" I ask.
"Doubt it. Be a pain to replace you at this stage," says Haymitch.
"What about my family?" I say. "Will they punish them?"
"Don't think so. Wouldn't make much sense. See, they'd have to reveal what happened in the training center for it to have any worthwhile effect on the population. People would need to know what you did. But they can't, since it's secret, so it'd be a waste of effort," says Haymitch. "More likely, they'll make your life hell in the arena." "Well, they've already promised to do that to us anyway," says Peeta.
"Very true," says Haymitch.
And I realize the impossible has happened. They have actually cheered me up. Haymitch picks up a pork chop with his fingers, which makes Effie frown, and dunks it in his wine. He rips off a hunk of meat and starts to chuckle.
"What were their faces like?"
I can feel the edges of my mouth tilting up. Shocked? Terrified? Ridiculous, some of them. An image pops into my mind. One man tripped backward into a bowl of punch. Haymitch guffaws, and we all start laughing except Effie, although even she is suppressing a smile.
"Well, it serves them right. It's their job to pay attention to you, and just because you come from District 12 is no excuse to ignore you."
Then her eyes dart around as if she said something totally outrageous.
"I'm sorry, but that's what I think,"
she says to no one in particular. "I'll get a very bad score," I say.
Scores only matter if they're very good. No one pays much attention to the bad or mediocre ones. For all they know, you could be hiding your talents to get a low score on purpose. People use that strategy, said Portia.
I hope that's how people interpret the 4 I'll probably get, says Peeta. If that, really, is anything less impressive than watching a person pick up a heavy ball and throw it a couple of yards. One almost landed on my foot.
I grin at him and realize that I'm starving. I cut off a piece of pork, dunk it in mashed potatoes, and start eating. It's okay. My family is safe. And if they are safe, no real harm has been done. After dinner, we go to the sitting room to watch the scores announced on television. First, they show a photo of the tribute, then flash their score below. The career tributes naturally get in the 8 to 10 range. Most of the other players average a 5. Surprisingly, little Rue comes up with a 7. I don't know what she showed the judges, but she's so tiny it must have been impressive. District 12 comes up last, as usual. Peeta pulls an 8, so at least a couple of game makers must have been watching him. I dig my fingernails into my palms as my face comes up, expecting the worst. Then, they're flashing the number 11 on the screen. 11? Effie Trinket lets out a squeal, and everybody is slapping me on the back and cheering and congratulating me. But it doesn't seem real. There must be a mistake. How could that happen? I ask Hamish.
Guess they like your temper, he says. They've got a show to put on. They need some players with some heat.
Katniss, the girl who was on fire, says Cinna and gives me a hug. Oh, wait until you see your interview dress.
More flames? I ask.
Of a sort, he says mischievously.
Peeta and I congratulate each other. Another awkward moment. We've both done well, but what does that mean for the other? I escape to my room as quickly as possible and burrow down under the covers. The stress of the day, particularly the crying, has worn me out. I drift off, reprieved, relieved, and with the number 11 still flashing behind my eyelids. At dawn, I lie in bed for a while, watching the sun come up. On a beautiful morning. It's Sunday. A day off at home. I wonder if Gail is in the woods yet. Usually we devote all of Sunday to stocking up for the week. Rising early, hunting and gathering, then trading at the hob. I think of Gail without me. Both of us can hunt alone, but we're better as a pair. Particularly if we're trying for bigger game. But also in littler things, having a partner lighten the load could even make the arduous task of filling my family's table enjoyable. I had been struggling along on my own for about 6 months when I first ran into Gail in the woods. It was a Sunday in October, the air cool and pungent with dying things. I'd spent the morning competing with the squirrels for nuts, and the slightly warmer afternoon wading in shallow ponds, harvesting catnip. The only meat I'd shot was a squirrel that had practically run over my toes in its quest for acorns. But the animals would still be afoot when the snow buried my other food sources. Having strayed farther afield than usual, I was hurrying back home, lugging my burlap sacks, when I came across a dead rabbit. It was hanging by its neck in a thin wire a foot above my head. About 15 yards away was another. I recognized the twitch-up snares because my father had used them. When the prey is caught, it's yanked into the air out of the reach of other hungry animals. I'd been trying to use snares all summer with no success, so I couldn't help dropping my sacks to examine this one. My fingers were just on the wire above one of the rabbits when a voice rang out.
That's dangerous!
I jumped back several feet as Gail materialized from behind a tree.
He must have been watching me the whole time. He was only 14, but he cleared 6 feet and was as good as an adult to me. I'd seen him around the seam and at school, and one other time. He'd lost his father in the same blast that killed mine. In January, I'd stood by while he received his Medal of Valor in the Justice Building, another oldest child with no father. I remembered his two little brothers clutching his mother, a woman whose swollen belly announced she was just days away from giving birth.
"What's your name?"
he said, coming over and disengaging the rabbit from the snare. He had another three hanging from his belt.
"Katniss?" I said, barely audible.
"Well, catnip, stealing's punishable by death, or hadn't you heard?" he said.
"Katniss," I said louder. "And I wasn't stealing. I just wanted to look at your snare. Mine never catch anything."
He scowled at me, not convinced.
"So where'd you get the squirrel?"
"I shot it." I pulled my bow off my shoulder. I was still using the small version my father had made me, but I'd been practicing with the full-size one when I could. I was hoping that by spring I might be able to bring down some bigger game.
Gale's eyes fastened on the bow.
"Can I see that?"
I handed it over. "Just remember, stealing's punishable by death." That was the first time I ever saw him smile. It transformed him from someone menacing to someone you wished you knew. But it took several months before I returned that smile. We talked hunting then. I told him I might be able to get him a bow if he had something to trade. Not food. I wanted knowledge. I wanted to set my own snares that caught a belt of fat rabbits in one day. He agreed something might be worked out. As the seasons went by, we grudgingly began to share our knowledge, our weapons, our secret places that were thick with wild plums or turkeys. He taught me snares and fishing. I showed him what plants to eat and eventually gave him one of our precious bows. And then one day, without either of us saying it, we became a team, dividing the work and the spoils, making sure that both our families had food. Gale gave me a sense of security I'd lacked since my father's death. His companionship replaced the long, solitary hours in the woods. I became a much better hunter when I didn't have to look over my shoulder constantly, when someone was watching my back. But he turned into so much more than a hunting partner. He became my confidant, someone with whom I could share thoughts I could never voice inside the fence. In exchange, he trusted me with his. Being out in the woods with Gale, sometimes I was actually happy. I call him my friend, but in the last year it seemed too casual a word for what Gale is to me. A pang of longing shoots through my chest. If only he was with me now. But of course, I don't want that. I don't want him in the arena, where he'd be dead in a few days. I just miss him, and I hate being so alone. Does he miss me? He must. I think of the 11 flashing under my name last night. I know exactly what he'd say to me.
"Well, there's some room for improvement there."
And then he'd give me a smile, and I'd return it without hesitating now. I can't help comparing what I have with Gale to what I'm pretending to have with Peeta. How I never questioned Gale's motives, while I do nothing but doubt the latter's. It's not a fair comparison, really. Gale and I were thrown together by a mutual need to survive. Peeta and I know the other's survival means our own death. How do you sidestep that?
Effie's knocking at the door, reminding me there's another big, big, big day ahead.
Tomorrow night will be our televised interviews. I guess the whole team will have their hands full readying us for that. I get up and take a quick shower, being a bit more careful about the buttons I hit,
and head down to the dining room. Peeta, Effie, and Haymitch are huddled around the table, talking in hushed voices. That seems odd, but hunger wins out over curiosity, and I load up my plate with breakfast before I join them. The stew's made with tender chunks of lamb and dried plums today. Perfect on the bed of wild rice. I've shoveled about halfway through the mound when I realize no one's talking. I take a big gulp of orange juice and wipe my mouth. So, what's going on? You're coaching us on interviews today, right?
That's right, says Haymitch.
You don't have to wait until I'm done. I can listen and eat at the same time, I say.
Well, there's been a change of plans about our current approach, says Haymitch.
What's that? I ask. I'm not sure what our current approach is. Trying to appear mediocre in front of the other tributes is the last bit of strategy I remember. Haymitch shrugs.
Peeta has asked to be coached separately.
Chapter 9. Betrayal. That's the first thing I feel, which is ludicrous. For there to be betrayal, there would have to have been trust first, between Peeta and me. And trust has not been part of the agreement. We're tributes. But the boy who risked a beating to give me bread, the one who steadied me in the chariot, who covered for me with the red-headed Avox girl, who insisted Haymitch know my hunting skills, was there some part of me that couldn't help trusting him? On the other hand, I'm relieved that we can stop the pretense of being friends. Obviously, whatever thin connection we'd foolishly formed has been severed. And high time, too. The games begin in 2 days, and trust will only be a weakness. Whatever triggered Peeta's decision, and I suspect it had to do with my outperforming him in training, I should be nothing but grateful for it. Maybe he's finally accepted the fact that the sooner we openly acknowledge that we are enemies, the better.
Good, I say. So what's the schedule?
You'll each have 4 hours with Effie for presentation and 4 with me for content, says Haymitch. You start with Effie, Katniss.
I can't imagine what Effie will have to teach me that could take 4 hours, but she's got me working down to the last minute. We go to my rooms, and she puts me in a full-length gown and high-heeled shoes, not the ones I'll be wearing for the actual interview, and instructs me on walking. The shoes are the worst part. I've never worn high heels, and can't get used to essentially wobbling around on the balls of my feet. But Effie runs around in them full time, and I'm determined that if she can do it, so can I. The dress poses another problem. It keeps tangling around my shoes, so of course I pitch it up, and then Effie swoops down on me like a hawk, smacking my hands and yelling,
"Not above the ankle!"
When I finally conquer walking, there's still sitting, posture. Apparently, I have a tendency to duck my head. Eye contact, hand gestures, and smiling. Smiling is mostly about smiling more. Effie makes me say 100 banal phrases, starting with a smile, while smiling and ending with a smile. By lunch, the muscles in my cheeks are twitching from overuse.
"Well, that's the best I can do," Effie says with a sigh. "Just remember, Katniss, you want the audience to like you."
"And you don't think they will?" I ask.
"Not if you glare at them the entire time. Why don't you save that for the arena? Instead, think of yourself among friends," says Effie.
"They're betting on how long I'll live," I burst out. "They're not my friends."
"Well, try and pretend," snaps Effie.
Then she composes herself and beams at me.
"See, like this, I'm smiling at you, even though you're aggravating me."
"Yes, it feels very convincing," I say. "I'm going to eat." I kick off my heels and stomp down to the dining room, hiking my skirt up to my thighs. Peeta and Haymitch seem in pretty good moods, so I'm thinking the content session should be an improvement over the morning. I couldn't be more wrong. After lunch, Hamish takes me into the sitting room, directs me to the couch, and then just frowns at me for a while.
What?
I finally ask.
I'm trying to figure out what to do with you, he says. How are we going to present you? Are you going to be charming, aloof, fierce? So far, you're shining like a star. You volunteered to save your sister. Cinna made you look unforgettable. You've got the top training score. People are intrigued, but no one knows who you are. The impression you make tomorrow will decide exactly what I can get you in terms of sponsors, says Hamish.
Having watched the tribute interviews all my life, I know there's truth in what he's saying. If you appeal to the crowd, either by being humorous or brutal or eccentric, you gain favor. What's Peter's approach, or am I not allowed to ask? I say.
Likeable. He has a sort of self-deprecating humor naturally, says Hamish. Whereas when you open your mouth, you come across more as sullen and hostile.
I do not, I say.
Please. I don't know where you pulled that cheery, wavy girl on the chariot from, but I haven't seen her before or since, says Hamish.
And you've given me so many reasons to be cheery, I counter.
But you don't have to please me. I'm not going to sponsor you, so pretend I'm the audience, says Hamish. Delight me.
Fine, I snarl. Hamish takes the role of the interviewer, and I try to answer his questions in a winning fashion. But I can't. I'm too angry with Hamish for what he said, and that I even have to answer the questions. All I can think of is how unjust the whole thing is, the Hunger Games. Why am I hopping around like some trained dog trying to please people I hate? The longer the interview goes on, the more my fury seems to rise to the surface, until I'm literally spitting out answers at him.
All right, enough, he says. We've got to find another angle. Not only are you hostile, I don't know anything about you. I've asked you 50 questions and still have no sense of your life, your family, what you care about. They want to know about you, Katniss.
But I don't want them to. They're already taking my future. They can't have the things that matter to me in the past, I say.
Then lie. Make something up, says Hamish.
I'm not good at lying, I say.
Well, you better learn fast. You've got about as much charm as a dead slug, says Hamish.
Ouch, that hurts. Even Hamish must know he's been too harsh because his voice softens.
Here's an idea. Try acting humble.
Humble, I echo.
That you can't believe a little girl from District 12 has done this well. The whole thing's been more than you ever could have dreamed of. Talk about Cinna's clothes, how nice the people are, how the city amazes you. If you won't talk about yourself, at least compliment the audience. Just keep turning it back around, all right? Gush.
The next hours are agonizing. At once, it's clear I cannot gush. We try me playing cocky, but I just don't have the arrogance. Apparently, I'm too vulnerable for ferocity. I'm not witty, funny, sexy, or mysterious. By the end of the session, I am no one at all. Hamish started drinking somewhere around witty, and a nasty edge has crept into his voice.
I give up, sweetheart. Just answer the questions and try not to let the audience see how openly you despise them.
I have dinner that night in my room, ordering an outrageous number of delicacies, eating myself sick, and then taking out my anger at Hamish, at the Hunger Games, at every living being in the capital, by smashing dishes around my room. When the girl with the red hair comes in to turn down my bed, her eyes widen at the mess.
Just leave it, I yell at her. Just leave it alone!
I hate her, too, with her knowing, reproachful eyes that call me a coward, a monster, a puppet of the capital, both now and then. For her, justice must finally be happening. At least my death will help pay for the life of the boy in the woods. But instead of fleeing the room, the girl closes the door behind her and goes to the bathroom. She comes back with a damp cloth and wipes my face gently, then cleans the blood from a broken plate off my hands. Why is she doing this? Why am I letting her? I should have tried to save you, I whisper. She shakes her head. Does this mean we were right to stand by? That she has forgiven me? No, it was wrong, I say. She taps her lips with her fingers, then points to my chest. I think she means that I would just have ended up an Avox, too. Probably would have. An Avox or dead. I spend the next hour helping the red-headed girl clean the room. When all the garbage has been dropped down a disposal and the food cleaned away, she turns down my bed. I crawl in between the sheets like a 5-year-old and let her tuck me in. Then she goes. I want her to stay until I fall asleep, to be there when I wake up. I want the protection of this girl, even though she never had mine. In the morning, it's not the girl, but my prep team, who are hanging over me. My lessons with Effie and Hamish are over. This day belongs to Cinna. He's my last hope. Maybe he can make me look so wonderful, no one will care what comes out of my mouth. The team works on me until late afternoon, turning my skin to glowing satin, stenciling patterns on my arms, painting flame designs on my 20 perfect nails. Then Venia goes to work on my hair, weaving strands of red into a pattern that begins at my left ear, wraps around my head, and then falls in one braid down my right shoulder. They erase my face with a layer of pale makeup and draw my features back out. Huge dark eyes, full red lips, lashes that throw off bits of light when I blink. Finally, they cover my entire body in a powder that makes me shimmer in gold dust. Then Cinna enters with what I assume is my dress, but I can't really see it because it's covered. "Close your eyes," he orders. I can feel the silken inside as they slip it down over my naked body. Then the weight. It must be 40 pounds. I clutch Octavia's hand as I blindly step into my shoes, glad to find they are at least 2 inches lower than the pair Effie had me practice in. There's some adjusting and fidgeting, then silence. "Can I open my eyes?" I ask. "Yes," says Cinna. "Open them." The creature standing before me in the full-length mirror has come from another world, where skin shimmers and eyes flash, and apparently they make their clothes from jewels. Because my dress, oh, my dress, is entirely covered in reflective precious gems, red and yellow and white, with bits of blue that accent the tips of the flame design. The slightest movement gives the impression I am engulfed in tongues of fire. I'm not pretty. I'm not beautiful. I am as radiant as the sun. For a while, we all just stare at me. "Oh, Cinna," I finally whisper. "Thank you."
"Twirl for me," he says.
I hold out my arms and spin in a circle. The prep team screams in admiration. Cinna dismisses the team and has me move around in the dress and shoes, which are infinitely more manageable than Effie's. The dress hangs in such a way that I don't have to lift the skirt when I walk, leaving me with one less thing to worry about.
"So,
All ready for the interview, then? Asks Cinna. I can see by his expression that he's been talking to Haymitch, that he knows how dreadful I am.
I'm awful. Haymitch called me a dead slug. No matter what we tried, I couldn't do it. I just can't be one of those people he wants me to be,
I say. Cinna thinks about this a moment. Why don't you just be yourself?
Myself? That's no good either. Haymitch says I'm sullen and hostile, I say.
Well, you are, around Haymitch, says Cinna with a grin. I don't find you so. The prep team adores you. You even won over the game makers. And as for the citizens of the capital, well, they can't stop talking about you. No one can help but admire your spirit.
My spirit? This is a new thought. I'm not sure exactly what it means, but it suggests I'm a fighter. In a sort of brave way. It's not as if I'm never friendly. Okay, maybe I don't go around loving everybody I meet. Maybe my smiles are hard to come by. But I do care for some people.
Cinna takes my icy hands in his warm ones. Suppose, when you answer the questions, you think you're addressing a friend back home. Who would your best friend be? Asks Cinna.
Gail? I say instantly. Only it doesn't make sense, Cinna. I would never be telling Gail those things about me. He already knows them.
What about me? Could you think of me as a friend? Asks Cinna.
Of all the people I've met since I left home, Cinna is by far my favorite. I liked him right off, and he hasn't disappointed me yet.
I think so, but I'll be sitting on the main platform with the other stylists. You'll be able to look right at me. When you're asked a question, find me, and answer it as honestly as possible, says Cinna.
Even if what I think is horrible?
I ask, because it might be, really. Especially if what you think is horrible, says Cinna. You'll try it?
I nod. It's a plan, or at least a straw to grasp at. Too soon, it's time to go. The interviews take place on a stage constructed in front of the training center. Once I leave my room, it will only be minutes until I'm in front of the crowd, the cameras, all of Panem.
As Cinna turns the doorknob, I stop his hand.
Cinna!
I'm completely overcome with stage fright. Remember, they already love you, he says gently. Just be yourself.
We meet up with the rest of the District 12 crowd at the elevator. Portia and her gang have been hard at work. Pita looks striking in a black suit with flame accents. While we look well together, it's a relief not to be dressed identically. Haymitch and Effie are all fancied up for the occasion. I avoid Haymitch, but accept Effie's compliments. Effie can be tiresome and clueless, but she's not destructive like Haymitch. When the elevator opens, the other tributes are being lined up to take the stage. All 24 of us sit in a big arc throughout the interviews. I'll be last, or second to last, since the girl tribute precedes the boy from each district. How I wish I could be first and get the whole thing out of the way. Now I'll have to listen to how witty, funny, humble, fierce, and charming everybody else is before I go up. Plus, the audience will start to get bored, just as the game makers did. And I can't exactly shoot an arrow into the crowd to get their attention. Right before we parade onto the stage, Haymitch comes up behind Pita and me and growls.
Remember, you're still a happy pair, so act like it.
What? I thought we abandoned that when Pita asked for separate coaching. But I guess that was a private, not a public thing. Anyway, there's not much chance for interaction now, as we walk single file to our seats and take our places. Just stepping on the stage makes my breathing rapid and shallow. I can feel my pulse pounding in my temples. It's a relief to get to my chair, because between the heels and my legs shaking, I'm afraid I'll trip. Although evening is falling, the city's circle is brighter than a summer's day. An elevated seating unit has been set up for prestigious guests, with the stylists commanding the front row. The cameras will turn to them when the crowd is reacting to their handiwork. A large balcony off a building to the right has been reserved for the game makers. Television crews have claimed most of the other balconies. But the city circle and the avenues that feed into it are completely packed with people. Standing room only. At homes and community halls around the country, every television set is turned on. Every citizen of Panem is tuned in. There will be no blackouts tonight. Caesar Flickerman, the man who has hosted the interviews for more than 40 years, bounces onto the stage. It's a little scary because his appearance has been virtually unchanged during all that time. Same face under a coating of pure white makeup. Same hairstyle that he dyes a different color for each Hunger Games. Same ceremonial suit, midnight blue, dotted with 1,000 tiny electric bulbs that twinkle like stars. They do surgery in the capital to make people appear younger and thinner. In District 12, looking old is something of an achievement since so many people die early. You see an elderly person, you want to congratulate them on their longevity. Ask the secret of survival. A plump person is envied because they aren't scraping by like the majority of us. But here it is different. Wrinkles aren't desirable. A round belly isn't a sign of success. This year, Caesar's hair is powder blue and his eyelids and lips are coated in the same hue. He looks freakish, but less frightening than he did last year when his color was crimson and he seemed to be bleeding. Caesar tells a few jokes to warm up the audience, but then gets down to business. The girl tribute from District 1, looking provocative in a see-through gold gown, steps up to the center of the stage to join Caesar for her interview. You can tell her mentor didn't have any trouble coming up with an angle for her. With that flowing blonde hair, emerald green eyes, her body tall and lush, she's sexy all the way. Each interview only lasts 3 minutes. Then a buzzer goes off and the next tribute is up. I'll say this for Caesar. He really does his best to make the tributes shine. He's friendly, tries to set the nervous ones at ease, laughs at lame jokes, and can turn a weak response into a memorable one by the way he reacts. I sit like a lady, the way Effie showed me, as the districts slip by. 2, 3, 4. Everyone seems to be playing up some angle. The monstrous boy from District 2 is a ruthless killing machine. The fox-faced girl from District 5, sly and elusive. I spotted Cinna as soon as he took his place, but even his presence cannot relax me. 8, 9, 10. The crippled boy from 10 is very quiet. My palms are sweating like crazy. But the jeweled dress isn't absorbent and they skid right off if I try to dry them. 11. Rue, who is dressed in a gossamer gown complete with wings, flutters her way to Caesar. A hush falls over the crowd at the sight of this magical wisp of a tribute. Caesar's very sweet with her, complimenting her 7 in training, an excellent score for one so small. When he asks her what her greatest strength in the arena will be, she doesn't hesitate. "I'm very hard to catch," she says in a tremulous voice. "And if they can't catch me, they can't kill me. So don't count me out."
"I wouldn't in a million years," says Caesar encouragingly.
The boy tribute from District 11, Thresh, has the same dark skin as Rue, but the resemblance stops there. He's one of the giants, probably 6.5 feet tall and built like an ox. But I notice he rejected the invitations from the career tributes to join their crowd. Instead, he's been very solitary, speaking to no one, showing little interest in training. Even so, he scored a 10, and it's not hard to imagine he impressed the game makers. He ignores Caesar's attempts at banter, and answers with a yes or no, or just remains silent. If only I was his size, I could get away with sullen and hostile, and it would be just fine. I bet half the sponsors are at least considering him. If I had any money, I'd bet on him myself. And then they're calling, Katniss Everdeen, and I feel myself as if in a dream, standing and making my way center stage. I shake Caesar's outstretched hand, and he has the good grace not to immediately wipe his off on his suit.
So, Katniss, the capital must be quite a change from District 12. What's impressed you most since you've arrived here?
Asks Caesar. What? What did he say? It's as if the words make no sense. My mouth has gone as dry as sawdust. I desperately find Cinna in the crowd and lock eyes with him. I imagine the words coming from his lips.
What's impressed you most since you arrived here?
I rack my brain for something that made me happy here. Be honest, I think. Be honest. The lamb stew, I get out. Caesar laughs, and vaguely I realize some of the audience has joined in.
The one with the dried plums?
Asks Caesar. I nod.
Oh, I eat it by the bucketful.
He turns sideways to the audience in horror, hand on his stomach.
It doesn't show, does it?
They shout reassurances to him and applaud. This is what I mean about Caesar. He tries to help you out.
Now, Katniss, he says confidentially. When you came out in the opening ceremonies, my heart actually stopped. What did you think of that costume?
Cinna raises one eyebrow at me. Be honest. You mean after I got over my fear of being burned alive? I ask. Big laugh, a real one from the audience.
Yes, start then, says Caesar.
Cinna, my friend. I should tell him anyway. I thought Cinna was brilliant, and it was the most gorgeous costume I'd ever seen, and I couldn't believe I was wearing it. I can't believe I'm wearing this either. I lift up my skirt to spread it out. I mean, look at it. As the audience oohs and ahs, I see Cinna make the tiniest circular motion with his finger. But I know what he's saying. Twirl for me. I spin in a circle once, and the reaction is immediate.
Oh, do that again, says Caesar.
And so I lift up my arms and spin around and around, letting the skirt fly out, letting the dress engulf me in flames. The audience breaks into cheers. When I stop, I clutch Caesar's arm.
Don't stop, he says.
I have to. I'm dizzy. I'm also giggling, which I think I've done maybe never in my lifetime. But the nerves and the spinning have gotten to me. Caesar wraps a protective arm around me.
Don't worry, I've got you. Can't have you falling in your mentor's footsteps.
Everyone's hooting as the cameras find Haymitch, who is by now famous for his head dive at the reaping, and he waves them away good-naturedly and points back to me.
It's all right, Caesar reassures the crowd. She's safe with me. So how about that training score? 11. Give us a hint what happened in there.
I glance at the game makers on the balcony and bite my lip. All I can say is I think it was a first. The cameras are tight on the game makers, who are chuckling and nodding.
You're killing us,
says Caesar, as if in actual pain.
Details, details.
I address the balcony. I'm not supposed to talk about it, right? The game maker who fell in the punch bowl shouts out,
"She's not!"
"Thank you," I say. "Sorry, my lips are sealed."
"Let's go back, then, to the moment they called your sister's name at the reaping," says Caesar.
His mood is quieter now.
"And you volunteered. Can you tell us about her?"
"No, no. Not all of you. But maybe Cinna. I don't think I'm imagining the sadness on his face. Her name's Prim. She's just 12, and I love her more than anything." You could hear a pin drop in the city circle now.
"What did she say to you after the reaping?" Caesar asks.
"Be honest, be honest." I swallow hard. "She asked me to try really hard to win." The audience is frozen, hanging on my every word.
"And what did you say?"
prompts Caesar gently. But instead of warmth, I feel an icy rigidity take over my body, my muscles tense as they do before a kill. When I speak, my voice seems to have dropped an octave. "I swore I would."
"I bet you did,"
says Caesar, giving me a squeeze. The buzzer goes off.
"Sorry, we're out of time. Best of luck, Katniss Everdeen. Tribute from District 12.
The applause continues long after I'm seated. I look to Cinna for reassurance. He gives me a subtle thumbs up. I'm still in a daze for the first part of Peeta's interview. He has the audience from the get-go, though. I can hear them laughing, shouting out. He plays up the baker's son thing, comparing the tributes to the breads from their districts. Then, has a funny anecdote about the perils of the capital showers.
"Tell me, do I still smell like roses?"
he asks Caesar, and then there's a whole run where they take turns sniffing each other that brings down the house. I'm coming back into focus when Caesar asks him if he has a girlfriend back home. Peeta hesitates, then gives an unconvincing shake of his head.
"Handsome lad like you, there must be some special girl. Come on, what's her name?"
says Caesar. Peeta sighs. "Well, there is this one girl. I've had a crush on her ever since I can remember, but I'm pretty sure she didn't know I was alive until the reaping." Sounds of sympathy from the crowd. Unrequited love they can relate to.
"She have another fellow?" asks Caesar.
"I don't know, but a lot of boys like her," says Peeta.
"So here's what you do. You win, you go home. She can't turn you down then, eh?"
says Caesar encouragingly. "I don't think it's going to work out. Winning won't help in my case," says Peeta.
"Why ever not?"
says Caesar, mystified. Peeta blushes beet red and stammers out,
Because she came here with me."
Part 2. The Games. Chapter 10. For a moment, the cameras hold on Peeta's downcast eyes as what he says sinks in. Then I can see my face, mouth half open in a mix of surprise and protest, magnified on every screen as I realize, me? He means me? I press my lips together and stare at the floor, hoping this will conceal the emotion starting to boil up inside of me.
"Oh, that is a piece of bad luck," says Caesar,
and there's a real edge of pain in his voice. The crowd is murmuring in agreement. A few have even given agonized cries.
"It's not good," agrees Peeta. "Well, I don't think any of us can blame you.
"It'd be hard not to fall for that young lady," says Caesar. "She didn't know?"
Peter shakes his head.
"Not until now."
I allow my eyes to flicker up to the screen long enough to see that the blush on my